in Seattle. I'm delighted to virtually be at Simon Fraser, where my very favorite aunt worked as a nurse for many years. And I'm really sorry to be here under these circumstances tonight. Amy didn't mention that my undergraduate degree was in physics. And that's the sort of experience that can scar you for life. And among the various scars that come from that are a tendency to try to simplify things. And in particular, if Einstein can try to explain everything in one grand unified theory, in my simplistic mind, I tend to divide the world into two parts. The internal universe of what goes on in your head, and that part out there in the physical world that we can sort of touch and measure and bump into and come to some agreements about. And in my mind, the role of science is to help us lubricate the interface between what's in here and what's out there. And the only way this can really happen is if you're willing to have an open mind about what's going on out there. And in this regard, in particular, the actions of the Bush administration have been particularly
demoralizing. A group of American and health officials today released a report saying that 655,000 Iraqis have died since the Iraq War. That figure is 20 times the figure that you cited in December at 30,000. Do you care to amend or update your figure, and do you consider this a credible report?
No, I don't consider it a credible report. Neither does General Casey, and neither do Iraqi officials. I do know that a lot of innocent people have died, and that troubles me, grieves me. And I applaud the Iraqis for their courage in the face of violence. I'm amazed that this is a society which so wants to be free that they're willing to, you know, that there's a level of violence that they tolerate. And it's now time for the Iraqi government to work hard to bring security in neighborhoods so people can feel at peace. No question it's violent, but this report is the one that put it out before, was pretty well just the methodology is pretty well discredited. But I talk to people like General Casey, and of course the Iraqi government put out a statement talking about the report.
30,000, Mr. President, do you stand by your figure? 30,000?
I stand by the figure. A lot of innocent people have lost their life. 600,000, whatever they guessed at, is just, it's not credible. Thank you.
So I'd like to spend just 10 minutes talking about our guests. This data was primarily collected and led by Riyad Lakhta. Can we have this up on the screen, please? In 2004, as I listened to the news, all I heard about was car bombs and roadside explosives and bullets, and in the other 7 hot war zones I had worked in up till that time, more people died from the indirect consequences of war. That is, the water systems not working and people getting diarrhea and women afraid to go out to the hospital and giving birth at home and hemorrhaging and all those things that go wrong when security goes awry. And I didn't hear any of that when I listened to National Public Radio or the New York Times. So I, through the internet, eventually met Riyad Lakhta, and we decided to do a study with 2 objectives: to figure out how many people had died and what they had died of. It turns out the U.S. government has been funding an effort to try to standardize the way mortality is measured during emergencies. And the basic logic is you go to at least 30 places, you assign clusters to those 30 places in a way so that the biggest places have the most chance you'll visit them, and the smaller places have a proportionally smaller chance you will visit them. You randomly pick a first house once you get to that neighborhood. You come up with some culturally appropriate way to ask people about deaths. And then when you analyze it, you take into account the fact that you went to a cluster of houses here and a cluster of houses there, and that it wasn't simply a random sample. In 2006, for example, we had pretty good estimates, we felt, from the Ministry of Health of how many people lived in each province, and we assigned clusters to them proportional to the size of that province. So, for example, Baghdad, with 6 million people, got 12 clusters. Nineveh, with under 3 million, got only 5. Each of them getting a number of visits proportional to the size of their province. Before the invasion, the only information that was coming out in the press or released by the Ministry of Health was on violent death. Up until that time, half of all the data coming from the two main sources, the Ministry of Health and a group in Oxford, England called Iraq Body Count, who've been monitoring newspaper reports in the English language, and every time there's a death cited in two separate sources, they put it in their database. Both of them have had half their deaths come from one place, the Baghdad morgue, in a country where most deaths don't go to morgues, and that there are dozens and dozens of morgues. So, in 2004, we attempted to go to 33 neighborhoods. We picked 33 at random across the country, and we made it to all of them. In 2006, we picked 50 neighborhoods across the country. We only made it to 47. The only main or only significant difference in the method between 2004 and 2006 was in 2004, when we got to a village or a part of the city, we would pick the first house where we started interviewing using one of those little GPS units like you might use when you're out hiking or boating. In 2006, the interviewers were so convinced that if they carried one of those around and got stopped at a checkpoint, that they would be accused of having a bomb detonator, or worse yet, they might be accused of having a GPS unit whose only purpose in Iraq is to target weapons. And so they were not, under any circumstance, going to carry one of these gizmos around in 2006. So this time, we just came up with a scheme by which we'd sort of find the main streets and pick one, and find the side streets and pick one, and if there are side streets up, then pick one, then count all the houses on that pick street, and start that way. In 2006, for the GPS scheme, when we'd get to a part of the city or a village, we'd scoot around with our GPS and make a simplified map and put grids on it with 100-meter spacings and put numbers on the grids and just pick two random numbers. And the moment we put ourselves on that theoretical construct of a grid, then suddenly that random place we picked was some magnetic heading and distance away from where we were. So this is about as good as finding a random starting point as we can come up with in settings of war. When we got to that random starting point, we had the GPS tell us what houses were the closest to it, and we interviewed the 30 closest to that randomly picked point. Realize in 2006, things were a little trickier, but we would assign clusters, one say, for example, going to Baghdad, down to a small neighborhood in Baghdad, which were of known population. We would scoot around and find all the main streets, find the side streets, pick one, pick a house on that street, and when you finished interviewing that house, we'd go to the next nearest door, and the next nearest, the next nearest, the next nearest, until 40 houses had been completed. We asked people who lived here on the 1st of January 2002. That's about 14 months before the invasion. Who lived here now? Had anyone been born or died? If they had died, we wrote down the details of the death. And at the end of the interview, when no one could have known this was coming, we said, oh, and by the way, do you have a death certificate to tell us about that death you had just told us about? 92% of the time, families could walk back in the house and come up with a death certificate. So we are very confident they didn't make these deaths up. We had a male and a female interviewer, mostly MDs, on each team. So if you knocked on the door and there's only a woman there, there would be a culturally appropriate interviewer. And they had a bunch of of shticks that they would employ to get good compliance in this study. First of all, I don't really understand why it is, but the world over, physicians love to wear white lab coats. And so these guys mostly wore their white lab coats when they were out interviewing. That sort of made them doctors and okay. Also, if they would knock on a door and a little kid would come to the door, Dr. Jamal here, for example, would say, oh, young man, can you go to the next house and tell them the doctor's going to be there in about 10 minutes? And that way, when the house next door heard the knock on the door and they opened it, the first face they saw was the young boy from next door. And in this culture where knocking on a stranger's door is very strange, this lowered the threshold or the shock associated with going and interviewing. Moreover, there were some other things. In 2004, when I was there, I and the driver would find out who the elder was in the neighborhood, and we'd go park our car in front of the elder's house and chat him up. That way, when they opened the door and looked down the street, the strangers were with the elder, and that must mean they were okay. Well, in 2004, we went to just under 1,000 houses. Less than 1% of people refused to participate. We only kept good absentee records in 27 of the 33 clusters, but our best estimate was about 7% of the time the house was occupied, but no one was there when we knocked on the door. In 2006, we went to twice as many houses. Less than 1% still refused to partake, and about 1% were absent. We can talk about why the difference later if you'd like. When we looked in 2004 at our data, in the 14 months before the invasion, the death rate was about 5 deaths per 1,000 people per year. In the US, it's about 7 per 1,000 people per year, but that's because we're a much older population. Half the population in Iraq is under 15, and so they have a younger and healthier population. This is slightly higher than Jordan, slightly higher than Syria, and just about the same as Iran in 2004. In the 18 months after the invasion, the death rate had more than doubled. When we looked at what people had died of before the invasion, they died of the same things they're dying of in Vancouver. They died of heart attacks and strokes and complications of chronic diseases and neonatal complications. When we looked in those 33 neighborhoods in 2004 at the death rate in each neighborhood, there were a couple of neighborhoods with no deaths. There are a couple of neighborhoods with a lot of deaths, but the bulk of them fell somewhere around the average. After the invasion, from our 2004 study, half of all the deaths were from violence. And then people were dying of the same things they had been dying of before. But when we looked at the death rates in the different neighborhoods in 2004, one neighborhood, the city of Fallujah, was just completely different than the others. It just was so strange that statistically you couldn't kind of lump it in with the others. If we set that Fallujah neighborhood aside, our best estimate was that about 100,000 people had died. Maybe a 50% chance it was higher, 50% chance it was lower, but when we included our thoughts about that Fallujah neighborhood, the only place in Anbar province that we had picked at random by chance, we were quite confident the death toll must have been at least 100,000. And we wrote it that way. And that sounds okay when I just said it, but to someone in the press to say, if the death toll's not around 100,000, it's probably far higher, sounds like we don't know what we're talking about. We also found that the violence death rate was up 58-fold, and most surprisingly for me was that airstrikes by the coalition accounted for most violent deaths. The coverage in the press of that 2004 study could not have been more different in Europe and North America. Pardon me, Europe and the United States, I should say. I apologize to our Canadian partners. Shame on me. In Europe, it was on the front page of the Guardian, Le Monde, and the Times of London. There was all this in-depth analysis articles in The Economist talking about what's a normal distribution and what does this mean. Three times in the week after this came out, Tony Blair was asked, what do you think about this study in The Lancet, saying 100,000 deaths? And the British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, wrote a five-page letter in response to the Lancet article. No one could remember the Foreign Secretary writing a response to a medical journal, and our colleagues at the Lancet were very chuffed about this. In the US, there was a wire service story, and the way wire service stories work tends to follow, they give you a paragraph that tells you the big punchline, they give you a paragraph that says what was done, they give you a paragraph that puts it in some context, and then they start tacking on paragraphs. I and my colleague Gil Burnham had a 40-minute interview with this woman from AP. And over the interview, I said how we'd use GPS units to pick our random points, and so I don't think that our biases affected where we went and how we did our work. She asked me about the timing of the report, and I said, yeah, I wanted it to come out before the election, because at least that way it would force the candidates to address the issue of protecting civilians. When I just said that, force the candidates, that sounded okay. But when you see that word in writing, force, has a real activist edge to it. She also asked, at the end of the interview, were you guys opposed to the invasion of Iraq? And I said, this wasn't a study about the invasion of Iraq. This was a study about the occupation of Iraq, and we all wanted that to go well. And Gil Burnham said, well, here at the Cedar Center, this is what we do. So she came back and she asked again, sort of dodged her again. She came back and asked a third time. There's this thing they teach you when you do media training. Don't ever answer a question that you don't want to answer. And when we see a politician doing that, we're really disgusted. And if she just did a little Google on me, she would see that I had resigned over my job at the International Rescue Committee because they took money from the U.S. government before the invasion to help with the humanitarian crisis. I was interviewed in the Wall Street Journal about my resignation, so I thought, why hide it? I said, yeah, this is less I was opposed to the invasion. So there was this paragraph in the AP wire service story that said something to the effect of, I was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. We wanted it to come up before the election to force the candidates to address the issue of protecting civilians. And I don't think that our biases or prejudices affected how we did our work. So I had said all of those sentences, but when you took them out of 40 minutes and put them together in a paragraph, they just sounded bad. The Washington Post actually interviewed us. That was good. Got almost every fact wrong. And most importantly, they called up a weapons analyst from Human Rights Watch and said, how do you feel about this study, saying that perhaps 100,000 have died in Iraq? And he said, you know, 100,000, that sounds really high to me. He said, I haven't seen the report. I haven't read the report, but 100,000, that sounds high to me. So they quoted him saying, 100,000 sounds high to me. He got to his office, started talking to his colleagues, saw the article, he never repeated it again, ever, ever. But he was the first person to discredit the study and the liberal end of things. So he was on CNN and one of the other major media television channels. He was on National Public Radio, and none of the authors were. There's a little bit of coverage in the liberal press, but most importantly, the next day two spin articles were written. One by a former Undersecretary of Defense, the other by the defense correspondent for Slate magazine, and they both were almost identical. They appeared online the next day. They said, wow, really cruel, these guys sneaking around in times of war. That's so hip. But they said, look at this confidence interval. They're 95% sure it's between 8,000 and 194,000. The guy in Slate wrote, that's not a result, that's a dartboard. Just proves we'll never know. And this message, so imprecise as to be meaningless, spread through the blogosphere with amazing speed. So in 2006, we used the same method, except for the GPS part. We went to twice as many places. The war had been going on for twice as long. So we used the same interviewers, essentially the same questionnaire, but because the war had had time to move around a lot more, we were quite sure that we wouldn't have that huge variation like we had with the Fallujah neighborhood, that there would then be a lot of places that had seen the war. Right. And we were confident that this problem of so imprecise as to be meaningless would go away. In the 14 months before the invasion, these households had a death rate of almost exactly what we had measured before, about 5 per 1,000 per year. And in the 40 months after, it was now more than twice as high. And this time, our point estimate was that about 650,000 people had died above the normal rate of death in Iraq, and the range, statistically speaking, was from shockingly high to shockingly high. So we were thinking, oh, there won't be any kibitzing this time. Silly us. Interestingly, the other sort of important findings were that Baghdad is slightly less violent than the nation as a whole. In fact, if you look at the Pentagon's data at attacks going on, divided by population to get a per capita attack rate, whatever that means, you come to the same conclusion. Adult males accounted for most of the deaths, and if anything, things are getting worse over time. If we look, seen here in green, at the crude death rate, things in 2006 are a lot worse than things in 2005. Most interestingly, when we look, seen here in blue, at our data from the first 2004 study, for that 18 months that the two studies overlap, they are almost identical. But of course, there had to be protests this time. I was called by a fellow who said he was a pollster, he had been working in Iraq, and that he'd been speaking with the Wall Street Journal, and he's going to write something for them to put these numbers in perspective. I didn't understand that this was actually Paul Bremer's pollster, and that when he was speaking to me from California, he was still employed by a consulting firm headed by Paul Bremer that essentially does Republican advocacy. And so he said in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, these guys, they only went to 47 neighborhoods. I wouldn't even pull a high school with 47 sampling points. Well, aside from the overwhelming evidence that there's not much point in going to more than 30 places in a survey like this, I said to him, if we look in our data, if we look at, shown here on our x-axis, the violent death rate, and shown here on our y-axis, among those 47 neighborhoods, we see how many of the neighborhoods fell into this sort of category of violence. Most neighborhoods had a lot of violence. And I said to this pollster, you know, if what you're saying is true, if by only going to 47 neighborhoods, we've somehow missed these rare pockets that are so different that had we encountered one, our results would change, well, that can only mean our results are too low. If you throw another zero into this distribution, your average is more or less unaltered. The only way one odd event can change this average is if there's a neighborhood where a lot of people have died. Ironically, this is cited again and again and again in the press as a criticism of the study, never by an epidemiologist, never by a biostatistician, without anyone ever mentioning that they can only mean that our study was too low. Another thing that was sort of conjured up by a couple of physicists from Oxford, where by chance Iraq Body Count is based, and by chance researchers associated with Iraq Body Count's project, they said, the Lancet study seems to suffer from a Main Street bias. That is, I took this right out of their report, that there are these neighborhoods that aren't near the main streets that would get missed by the Lancet methodology, and everyone knows the car bombs are going off more in the main streets, and therefore, the Lancet study is biased and has an elevated estimate. Well, first of all, only about 13% of deaths come from car bombs and ordnance of that sort. So it's only a tiny part of deaths that could be affected. And we believe the vast majority of people who are killed violently are killed away from their homes. So, first of all, I don't even understand the mechanism by which this bias could occur. But if ever, in the history of war epidemiology, there's been an argument like this that could be discarded, it's here, because remember, we've done it two ways over the first 18 months of occupation. In dotted line here, using a GPS unit to find our house, and in the solid line here, using our picking a street, picking a side street, picking a house method, and we got identical results. And yet, somehow, this criticism has been cited in Nature and Science, not because anyone with any expertise or credibility is saying it so, but because there is this need in the press to make things controversial. I know the New York Times had to call about 10 people before they would find someone who was willing to say, no, this method is wrong. And they didn't mention those other 9. They just wrote a story, said, oh, here's someone who says it's right. Here's a cancer statistician in Texas who's never worked internationally and says it's wrong. And voila, they've got a balanced story. So, needless to say, we didn't get all that much traction this time around either. There are now a host of sources out there estimating either rates of death or numbers of deaths. And the two that are most commonly cited in the Western press are the Iraq Body Count Monitoring of Newspaper Reports and the Ministry of Health. Realize there are 3 of these, the 2 Lancet studies and a study by military researchers looking at post-traumatic stress disorder that discovered in 2004 that 14% of returning Army soldiers and 28% of returning Marines said they accidentally killed a non-combatant while in Iraq. If you start sort of working that through in terms of the 140,000 soldiers that were there and the fraction that were Marines and the fraction that were Army, and you make the assumption that they've all got a really good heart, and so every time someone's killed, 2 people take credit for it, you come up with a number higher than the Lancet study. So it turns out in the peer-reviewed literature, that is in the scientific literature, there's no controversy about the number of deaths in Iraq. It's only these other sort of non-academic sources that are creating the controversy. And the problem as I see it is, as of last summer, the Ministry of Health, the U.S. government, Iraq Body Count, were saying that about 40,000 violent deaths had occurred, while we were saying about 600,000 violent deaths had occurred. And there is overwhelming evidence that it wasn't just 40,000 as of last summer or 60,000 as of today. For example, the majority of deaths in our surveys don't appear in Iraq Body Count's data set. And in Basra, last April, local officials said repeatedly that there was a killing per hour in that city during that month. And if you go through Iraq Body Count's data set, you can't come up with more than about 2% that many, no matter what day you start looking back for a month. The UN puts out a security report every month or two, and they said that the Iraqi government surveillance network last July in Anbar province recorded exactly 0 violent deaths, in spite of the fact that we had about 4 soldiers and a couple dozen American soldiers wounded, and it was probably the most violent month there they had seen in many months before that. And finally, the Ministry of Health surveillance system, in the year before the invasion, only captured about 1/3 of all deaths. That is, we know there are about 130,000-ish deaths from natural causes. The system only caught 40,000. So what makes us think that a war and all this violence is going to make the system somehow more complete? If we look across Iraq as a whole, Baghdad, as I mentioned earlier, isn't quite as violent as the national average, and yet, as of last summer, it accounted for more than 3/4 of all the deaths reported by the Ministry of Health and Iraq Body Count, and it's only 20% of the population. 20% of the population, less violent than average, 80% of the recorded deaths. That suggests a problem. On the other hand, if there are 140-ish thousand deaths per year, our study is saying that over these last 4 years now, there have been even more deaths lately from violence. The Iraq government claims, President Bush's claims, are that the death rate's only up about 10%. You know, all these stories about overflowing morgues in Baghdad and the need for brigades to collect bodies and the need to create new graveyards in Najaf because the others are overflowing, that's not consistent with a 10% rise in death rate. In the end of 2005, December, when George Bush finally, after more than a year, was asked by someone who happened to have not been a member of the press, just someone from the public at a forum in Philadelphia, how many civilians have died in Iraq? He said, oh, I think more or less 30,000, citing apparently Iraq body counts data set. If that was true, in those first 2.5 years of occupation, probably Detroit, Baltimore, and New Orleans had a higher murder rate than did Iraq. You know, in 2004, I was in Baltimore and I was in Iraq, and I don't think so. Moreover, when we look at the few places that we're getting data from, for example, the Baghdad morgue, there were a little more than 200 deaths on average in the year before, per month, in the year before the US invasion, about 15 deaths being from violence. The last few months, the Baghdad morgue has had more than 1,500 violent deaths each month. Now that sevenfold increase in bodies coming into the Baghdad morgue is not consistent with a 10% rise in baseline. A fellow at Berkeley, who worked for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, worked for the UN in Kosovo, collected some data for the country of Guatemala. And he looked from 1960 to 1995 at two things. At the number of violent killings, shown here in the black solid line, peaking in the early 80s at about 7,000 killings per year. And then he looked on our Y1 axis here at the percent of those killings captured by the media. And you'll notice that in the years when violence is really low, most deaths are captured by the media. In the years when violence is really high, not even 5% of deaths were captured by the media. Those of us who work in war zones find this very intuitive. For reasons I don't actually completely understand, members of the press are somewhat adverse to being killed. So when things get really bad, they're not skirting around in the countryside, exploring every village and getting good records. And when things are relatively calm, murders are sort of exciting and talked about, and they're catching most of them. This is extremely counterintuitive to members of the press. They think, we're out there busting our butts, we're spending millions of dollars per year to get the story, how could we be missing so much? If we look at Mark White's online encyclopedia of wars and disasters, and the estimated death tolls associated with those wars, and the big ones since Vietnam, only four of those wars had any epidemiologically based evidence regarding the death toll while the war was going on. That is to say, most of the time when there's a war, a couple of academics look at census data a decade later, or maybe in southern Sudan, a couple of reporters, a couple of priests sit down, they drink three bottles of whiskey, and a number is born, and that's where our estimates come from. So I guess it shouldn't surprise us that the press isn't really good at digesting information about death tolls and wars because they don't get much practice. Except, well, not except, but I accept that out there in society, there are certain people who have made up their mind that we were attacked and we needed to kick some butt and good for us for going to Iraq. This happens to be from the front yard of one of my neighbors in upstate New York. This is a mock missile on the top of a truck. It says from the New York Police Department, Fire Department of New York, to Saddam and his boy Osama with care. I guess he didn't read the 9/11 Commission report saying there was not a link between those two, but that said, my gut feeling is our epidemiological data were not going to change this guy's mind. So, this was sent to me by actually a Republican congressional staffer. And I likewise accept that there are certain people who think this war was a bad idea, and if our mortality survey had decided that two people had died, it wouldn't have changed them either because war is bad and they were going to condemn this no matter what. You know, I accept that on both ends of the political spectrum there are people who are destined to be unencumbered by data or reality. I just didn't expect the press to be among them. Our issue of deaths of civilians is not the only gaping shortfall by the press. For example, by the end of 2004, according to three different weapons analysts that I heard speak, we had dropped 50,000 bombs in Iraq, 28,000 during the shock and awe, about 20,000 the next 20 months or so. If you had been reading the New York Times, if you had been listening to National Public Radio, you would have thought there were more car bombs, more roadside explosives going off in Iraq than bombs from our plane. That's not wrong. That's wrong by a factor of 10. And I don't know if you remember, but in the days leading up to the election in 2004, the city of Fallujah was surrounded. They were shelling it. And we heard our Pentagon spokespeople say again and again and again that we believe there are only 3,000 to 5,000 mostly foreign combatants in Fallujah, so it's okay that we're bombing the hell out of them. Though, the day after the election, troops go in, they kill a lot of people, we don't exactly know how many, they capture 1,600 prisoners. Of 1,600 prisoners, exactly 30 were identified as foreign combatants. So it's gone from most of 3,000 to 5,000 to 30 out of 1,600. And we probably had had more military action in the city of Fallujah than anywhere else on the planet since the Vietnam War. And if our intelligence was that bad, that makes the weapons of mass destruction issue look trivial. And if they knew better, then how shocking that they were bombing the hell out of civilians and calling them foreign combatants so no one would complain about it. And the examples go on and on and on, but most recently, just, I think it was three Thursdays ago, Jamie Terabay was reporting from Iraq. She's embedded with some soldiers, and she's with this captain, Captain Pugh. And his men radio in, they say, we've got three guys with very funny IDs. And we're suspicious. So the piece goes on, and they discover that one of them has their hands tested positive for TNT. So the captain says to his soldier through the radio, with NPR blasting this to millions of people, we'll get rocking and rolling and go beat him up. So there it was. The order to torture, played on National Public Radio, some would call sort of liberal clientele, and no outcry, no, how can this be, why is there an investigation? It has just come to the point where we're so embedded that these things roll off us like water off a duck. There are many, many things that have happened that make the prevention of Riyad Lakhdar from coming and speaking part of a pattern. The first interim minister of health, someone who had spent his life as a military surgeon, someone who is board certified in pediatrics and psychiatry and surgery and has an MPH, incredibly qualified, went to Iraq and said, my highest priority is to set up morbidity and mortality surveillance. He says he was stopped by his superiors from doing that. The next minister of health in Iraq, pardon me, not the next, the first Iraqi minister of health produced some data, at least his shop did, saying that most of the people being killed in 2004 were being killed by the coalition, and he was replaced. When the first Lancet study came out, people called up the Centers for Disease Control and said, you're our National Institute for Epidemiology. Can someone there comment on this Lancet study? They said, nope, nope, nope. But there is a statistician at Harvard who's familiar with the study and can discuss it. They gave his number. That statistician was actually at the American Enterprise Institute, and he was a signatory on the Project for the New American Century. The world's most renowned expert on mortality in times of disaster works at the Centers for Disease Control. So last November, when there was a congressional briefing and Congress wanted us to come and present our Lancet study and other people to come, and this expert to come and critique the various work, the CDC refused to let him go. So these two congressmen, Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich, petitioned up to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who said, no, we won't let him go. The UK, it just was revealed 3 weeks ago, evaluated the Lancet study when it first came out by two different groups, both of whom concluded it was robust, and the military reviewers concluded it was probably an underestimate. So Tony Blair, don't rubbish this study. Needless to say, the next day he went out and rubbished the study. And finally, there's the Bush denial you just heard. I think it's important, if we're having a surge, to know the level of security. And if we can't say what the level of security is within a factor of 10, how will we know whether or not the surge worked? Moreover, I think it's naive to suggest, as the Iraqi government did last summer, that about 1 in 80 households had lost someone, and our study is saying 1 in 7 households had lost someone, and to think that doesn't matter. In this culture where family and revenge and honor are so important, it matters a lot if it's 1 in 7 families or 1 in 70. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, at a time when our people know we should be expressing contrition, to be downplaying the number of dead by a factor of 10 is to be sounding quite belligerent in the ears of those in the Middle East. And I'm not sure this is in our long-term interest. If we think about the people in Iraq today and who Riyad Lakhdar is, he is on the extreme end of being tolerant and cooperative with the West. When he was going up north in 2004 for several days to cover the Kurdish turf, and we had had a bad experience, so I was just hiding in my hotel room with the furniture stacked against the door. I said to him, okay, well, if people come in after me and I jump off the balcony and run away, is there anyone you can suggest that I go seek in order to find sanctuary? And in essence, he eventually came up with one person, but no one he knew would be willing to hide an American. In that setting, for us to be preventing a guy who is willing to work as partners with us, who risks his life on the assumption that the compassion of the West can be influenced by good data, for him to be stifled is particularly obscene. And I live in fear. I live in fear of what our grandchildren are going to ask us about today. I'm worried they're going to say, "Grandma, I don't get it. How could it be that there are these millions and millions of people who are so immature, so inexperienced, that they're forbidden by law to go into a bar and buy a beer, but these same 18 to 20-year-olds can be given a fully automatic weapon, sent to the other side of the planet, to a place where they're despised, and think that bad things aren't going to happen? How could people have reconciled that?" Or they're going to say to me, "Grandpa, your mother grew up in a convent. You were an altar boy. How is it that somehow this president portrayed himself as a Christian, that soldiers are talking about this venture as a Christian venture, and as best I can tell, there are no caveats in thou shalt not kill that say, unless your commander-in-chief asks you to, or unless you think your country is at risk." I think we all, when we were young, had this notion: had we been in Germany in 1938, we would have stood up to Hitler. Had we lived in the South in the 1840s, we wouldn't have tolerated slavery. But that somehow, we would have had the strength of character to transcend our time. And I think back to Huck Finn. I don't know if you remember the book, The Adventures of Huck Finn, but Huck ends up with a runaway slave, and they spend most of the book floating down a river and having all sorts of adventures. And Huck is plagued through the whole book by guilt. He knows that it's a sin to help a slave, an escaped slave. And it's just weighing on him more and more and more. And it's just tormenting him. And at the end, he doesn't know what to do. So he decides he's going to write a letter to Ms. Watson, the owner of Jim the Slave. And towards the end of the book, he does. And he writes the letter. Sighs, relief. And he said, "I felt good and washed clean of sin for the first time I had ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off. But I laid the paper down and sat there thinking. Thinking how good it was this all happened so, and how near I'd come to being lost and going to hell. And I went on thinking, and I got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime. Sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along, talking and singing and laughing. But somehow, I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n, calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see him how glad he was when I come to him back out of the fog, and when I come to him again up in the swamp where the feud was in such light times. And would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last, I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard, and he was so grateful, and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world, and the only one he's got now. And then I looked around, and I happened to see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was trembling, because I got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and I says to myself, all right then, I go to hell, and I tore it up. That rascal, Huck Finn set an exceptionally high standard of what it means to be an American. And I'm fearful we're not living up. Thank you.